Hey y'all. How's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. War's still on in Gaza. In fact, let me see the latest body count here. We got it at antiwar.com, I think. No? Guess not. Alright, well, I know it's more than 1,800. Hang on a second. Latest body count? Yeah. Alright, there's a new Greenwald out today about the NSA. How the NSA helps the Israelis target Palestinians for killing. New Snowden documents detailing all of that. And then there's a ton of Iraq news, huge Iraq news to cover today. Well, the nation state formerly known as Iraq. Lots to cover there. Eric Margolies is going to be on the show. And that'll be here in a while. That should be good. And I got, 10 invites out or something. What, do my emails smell funny or something? What is the damn deal? Did I mess up and say the F word a bunch of times in a bunch of these interviews? Or I don't know. Maybe everybody's just really busy. But I got a bunch of invites out, so it could be that I'll just sit here and complain for 3 hours today, other than the Margolies interview. Try not to complain all through his interview. It also could be that there will be 6 interviews on the show, and all the emails are going to start coming here any moment now. It's live radio, man. These things, you know, it's hard to predict. And yes, that's correct. I put off all of my inviting until the very last minute, right before the show starts. That is correct. All right. So Eric Garris says that's the boss at antiwar.com. He says 1,849 was the body count last night. He's looking for updated numbers right now. Again, according to the United Nations, 80% of those killed have been civilians, and including now more than 300 children. And the war continues to rage on. Oh, it's 1,888 right now, according to Eric Garris at antiwar.com. Oops. So, there you go. Almost 1,900 dead. The Israelis were saying yesterday, nuh-uh, we say almost half have been combatants, militants, men, either with rifles or somehow accused of being associated with Hamas. Almost half, huh? Good going, guys. 300 kids. 300 kids. You know, somebody tweeted me a clip of Cornel West giving a speech at a Gaza rally over the weekend. And he took time to pause and make sure to remind everyone that they understood that a Palestinian child is worth just as much as a white kid from Newtown, Connecticut. Their lives are priceless. Just like American kids. Just like the ones of us that we're supposed to care the most about. Well, somebody cares about these Palestinian kids that much too. And the thing is it sounds so stupid that he has to stop and say that, but he does have to stop and say that, doesn't he? Because otherwise, you would get the impression that, yeah, you know, they killed a bunch of guys and kids, but whatever, those are the breaks and blah, blah, blah. That's how Bill Maher talks, and he's just representing the American kind of consciousness on the issue. Yeah, some guys and kids died, so what? TV says that we don't worry about that. So, what am I going to worry about that? And Cornel West was saying that, yeah. And in fact, I'm glad that he brought up Newtown, because part of the horror of that wasn't just that they were six-year-olds, it was that he shot them with a rifle, you know, basically the equivalent of like a deer rifle or something, right? And people just couldn't help but imagine the horror of that, to think of little babies, little six-year-old children dying that way, being murdered that way. That is so horrible. You know? But, so yeah, here too. These kids are being crushed to death by falling concrete if they're lucky enough to not just have their bodies torn apart by high-velocity explosives. That's how they're dying. You know, maybe just have one limb shorn off and then they bleed out laying in the street. That kind of thing. That's what the Israeli government is doing to little kids in Gaza right now. More than 300 of them now. And they say, oh, everything that happens is always the victim's fault. And yet it was the Israelis who broke their own latest ceasefire 30 minutes after it happened. And all they did, all they accomplished by bombing this refugee camp, they bombed a house in a refugee camp near the Rafah border crossing, and they killed a little girl and injured, 30 others, something like that. Was she the enemy combatant that they were going after? But whatever. Everybody knows whenever Israel kills somebody's tiny, helpless child, it's retaliation for something that was done to them. Because I said so, right? It doesn't matter whether everybody knows, because it's an absolute scientific fact that the Israelis were bombing Gaza before the first rocket took off this time. It doesn't matter that everybody knows that Benjamin Netanyahu knew he was lying when he pretended for 3 weeks that the boys were still alive, when he knew that they'd been murdered by two guys who were not Hamas, while he was rounding up hundreds of people pretending that Hamas had kidnapped these kids and whooping up Israeli hysteria that there was a chance that they were going to be found alive, getting their hopes up to the highest and then crushing them. All while at the same time, Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, was calling Hamas and by implication, the Palestinians, animals. Animals. Can you imagine if George W. Bush had said, hey, look, the Afghans, they're animals, okay? So, yeah, we're dropping daisy cutters on them, but they're not really all the way quite human, and so it's fine. Can you imagine if he had said that? That was the excuse? No, the excuse when America kills kids is we're using laser pointers and we're trying so hard to be careful. And sometimes these things happen. Not our enemies are animals, and so it's okay to slaughter their children. Which is what Benjamin Netanyahu says. And his entire government just whooping it up like the leaders of some clan mob against their helpless captive, quote-unquote, enemies. Then came the lynching of the young Palestinian boy who they burned to death. They made him drink gasoline and then lit it on fire. Then they started bombing Gaza. Then the rockets shot back in retaliation. And then Israel pretended like that rocket was the first thing that ever happened in history and that they're only defending themselves. That's why 300 kids are dead. Because the Israeli government, they're liars and murderers. And they like to tell lies so they can justify murdering people. Including little kids.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. What a crazy time. Andrea Mitchell from NBC News just tweeted out, former Israeli ambassador Michael Oren on U.S. condemnation of Israeli attack on U.N. school. She says near U.N. school, liar. Israeli attack on U.N. school, that'd be the fourth one that actually had people in it, the seventh overall. Anyway, tangents. Former Israeli ambassador Michael Oren on U.S. condemnation of Israeli attack on U.N. school. Quote, I expect more from our allies. Isn't he an American? Yes, he is a former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., but I think he was from the U.S. in the first place, no? And now he's a paid expert on CNN. But when he talks about we and us and our, there ain't no mistaking, is there? Just like when he was talking about the rise of the Islamic State and he was saying, fine by me. From the Israeli point of view, meaning the Israeli government point of view, which he only very recently stopped officially representing. From the Israeli point of view, we prefer the Sunnis to the Shia, because the Shia are backed by Iran. Hezbollah, backed by Iran. Assad in Syria, backed by Iran. Maliki, backed by Iran. So, yes, the Islamic State are a bunch of bin Ladenite, crazy suicide bomber, September 11th types, but that's fine by me. I mean, I'm only speaking for myself, not the rest of the Israeli government, I swear, he amended. And yet, but we just heard him say, from the Israeli point of view, we like the rise of ISIS. We prefer ISIS to Hezbollah. Anyway, no question who's us and who's we and who's our when Michael Oren is talking. And damn it, Israel is just disappointed as can be with America right now. How can you verbally attack us for physically attacking a UN shelter full of men, women, and children with high explosives? Huh? When? I expect more from our allies. He cries. It's like Benjamin Netanyahu and this one, man. You talk about chutzpah. I can't believe this. I can believe it, but I almost can't believe this. You guys saw this, right? Benjamin Netanyahu said, quote, don't ever second guess me again on the question of the ceasefire that was supposed to take place over the weekend, that the Israelis called off because they pretended that Hamas had captured one of their soldiers during a tunnel-clearing mission in the middle of a ceasefire. Is that it? Oh, ceasefires are for you, not for me. I get it. So Israel was violating the ceasefire, and then Hamas captured an Israeli soldier, and then the Israelis, deliberately or otherwise, but seemingly deliberately, bombed the hell out of their own guy, along with the Hamas soldiers who had captured him, and killed them all. And then they just pretended. They just lied, just like they did with the three kidnapped kids back in June. They just lied and pretended that Hamas had captured somebody, and said, oh, see, you broke the ceasefire. Even though even their story had it that they were in the middle of breaking the ceasefire when their soldier got taken. But so here was Netanyahu saying to the United States of America, who absolutely pays their way, arms their way, as Greenwald breaks the story today, helps them pick their targets, has their back in every way, vetoes every Security Council resolution against them, blocks every attempt to hold them to account in any way. And all Benjamin Netanyahu has to say to America, and he doesn't even do like Michael Oren and say us or we, like he's pretending to be any kind of statesman representing the Israeli government. He says, don't second guess me again. Holy crap. Man, if I was Barack Obama, I'd be like, you know what, pal? You can kiss the blackest part of my ass. You're done. And in fact, you know what? I'm telling on you to the American people. Tonight, everybody, from the Oval Office, the real story on Israel's relationship to the USA, starring me, your president, Barack Obama, and John Brennan, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, who's going to release a bunch of information that I'm hereby declassifying about Israeli spying and backstabbing, subterfuge and manipulation and bankrolling America's enemies and selling our technology to the Chinese. You backstabbing, treacherous, traitorous child murderers. Don't ever second guess you again. How about no more F-16s or F-15s or dollars for you ever again? You can kill people and make enemies on your own dime. And see how well it works out for you with your little minority dictatorship over there for the long term. Oh, and in fact, you know what? As long as you're kissing my black ass, I, on behalf of the United States government, and hell, for that matter, NATO, hereby recognize the sovereign state of Palestine in East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. And how do you like that, Mr. Never Second Guess Me Again? Or did you forget who was paying your way here? Absolutely unbelievable. This piece of crap little country, Israel. Oh, our best ally in the Middle East. Our best ally in the whole wide world. Really, name one thing they've ever done for us. Ever. Ever. Other than make enemies for us. George H.W. Bush invaded Iraq. Pretend for a moment that that wasn't halfway on behalf of Israel in the first place, but that that was actually even based on an American self-interest. H.W. Bush had to beg Israel to stay out of the war. Because if they fired one missile into Iraq, it would have completely broken the coalition and would have completely undermined the entire theory that all we were doing was fighting to restore the sovereignty of Kuwait under UN resolutions and blah, blah, blah. Whatever you do, Israel, don't help us fight. And then I don't think I even need to tell you, because you all know now, that the neoconservative movement, the Israel First, Lockheed First movement in America, lied us into war on behalf of Ariel Sharon and the Likud party in Israel in the first place. Read Julian Borger in The Guardian, The Spies Who Push for War. You can read Robert Dreyfus in The Nation, Agents of Influence. You can listen to my interviews with Lawrence Wilkerson, Colin Powell's right-hand man, saying Fife and Wormser were both working directly for the government of Israel, lying us into war. Goddamn break. I'll be back in a second with more complaining like this. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys. Welcome back. So listen, all I was going to say there was a huge part, not the whole thing, but a huge part of the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was about Israel, as I keep telling you. You'll laugh your ass off. I swear to God, it's worth your time to read the article, How Chalabi Conned the Neocons
It was written in Salon.com 10 years ago, and it's just a riot. It's unbelievable how stupid Richard Pearl and his merry men, Ariel Sharon and his merry men in the United States are, that they fell for an Iranian plot to lie to Israel's partisans in America that the new regime changed Iraq would be Israel's best friend in the whole wide world and would marginalize Hamas and Hezbollah and would build an oil and water pipeline to Haifa and whatever you want to hear, you stupid idiots. And that's what they told them, and the neocons fell for it. And yet even then we're fighting a war primarily, or well, in large measure, for Israeli interests. There's no question as to whether America would have wanted Israel to help us invade Iraq. Absolutely not. All your F-15s and all your F-16s and all your tanks and all your guns and grenades that we've given you, the last thing we want is for you to help us, because we don't want it to look like what we're doing is what Israel wants. And if our war against Iraq publicly seems as though it's about Israel, then it's going to blow up in our face. Right? Just like David Petraeus testified before the Senate, Israel's abuse of the Palestinians, even, is a threat to our security. If we had IDF soldiers fighting, standing shoulder to shoulder with American Army and Marines in Iraq, it would have been 100% worse, 100% faster in every way. Now, and then on the other hand, we spent the last, ever since the invasion of Iraq, trying to make sure that Israel can't get us into a war with Iran, because they want a regime change in Iran so bad. They're so damn paranoid about industrial grade uranium being enriched to fund the Bushehr reactor. They want you to believe that it's tantamount to nuclear weapons when it's not. And they have gone to extraordinary lengths, again, working with the neoconservatives in America, to try to get us into war with Iran. Not for our interests, for theirs. So who is whose ally? When the CIA says a war with Iran would be an absolute disaster, the military says it'd be a disaster. It would ruin the entire world economy, drive oil up past $200 a barrel, would end up, you know, getting Americans killed all across the region because they're within retaliatory missile range of the Iranians, at the bases in Bahrain, for example, the 5th Fleet stationed there, all our soldiers in Afghanistan, the embassy the embassy in Baghdad is completely surrounded by pro-Iran partisans. Never mind the Islamic State. Those are our friends in Iraq right now. The threat of Israel drumming up some kind of conflict with Iran is one of the worst crises in American foreign policy. They're not our ally in any way. They're nothing but a liability. And, I don't know. Well, they're the only democracy. Yeah, because Israel objected when Islamists won in Algeria in 93, so America canceled the election there. Lebanon has regular elections, but that doesn't count, I guess, because Hezbollah is part of the ruling coalition there, because they got the votes. Hezbollah, that never existed until Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982 and stayed, and it rose up as the grassroots local Shiite militia to kick them out, when they were ostensibly there for the PLO. They weren't even there for the Shiites of southern Lebanon, but made an enemy out of them anyway, somehow. Anyway, to think that the Prime Minister of Israel, well, and it's fitting, isn't it, that he would say, "Don't you second guess me again," on an issue where specifically, narrowly, he's 100% wrong. What happened to the ceasefire on Friday? Israel killed their own guy with an artillery shell and then lied and said that that Hamas had him and that Hamas had broken the ceasefire. And now, I'm not saying this is a proven fact, but there is a discourse going on right now over whether this was part of what they call the Hannibal Directive, which is that it's better to kill a man, to kill one of your own soldiers, than let him be taken captive.
Why? Because Hamas will torture him to death and, you know, are fate worse than death, blah, blah. No. Just because strategically it would be bad for Israel if they have to let some innocent prisoners that they've rounded up and captured go free in exchange for them. You know, it could crimp their policy. So they have a thing. I didn't make that up. They're the ones who made it up. The Israeli military has a thing called the Hannibal Directive. I'm not saying I know, and I don't think anybody has reported that they know for a fact that it has been put into effect here, that the order has been given. But it sure looks like that's possible. If it's really right that Hamas grabbed this soldier and then the Israelis killed all three of them with artillery. You know, the two Hamas guys and the captive. And so he was lying about that. Netanyahu was lying about what happened at the moment he was telling the Americans, who do everything for him, that you better never second guess me again. I just can't believe that. That is just, I mean, I can't believe it, but it's still, it's incredible. And then as Andrea Mitchell is tweeting out, Michael Oren echoes Benjamin Netanyahu, I expect better from our allies, meaning Israel really resents the Americans telling them to stop bombing UN schools full of civilian refugees. Huh. Because it seems like maybe the Americans could expect better of our allies. That you don't go around bombing schools full of civilian refugees. For the fourth time. Oops, we accidentally bombed a school. Yeah, we ought to win our Nobel Prize for restraint in this war. Oh, we do everything in the world that we can to avoid any civilian casualties. Oops, we just bombed our fourth UN school full of refugees. I don't know, man. Although, you know, people say it's not fair, all the imbalance in the media, too many Israeli representatives on TV and all that. But you know what? I saw some Israeli spokeslady on CNN this morning, and I was laughing my ass off at her. I say, give me more of that. Give me more smirking, smart aleck, spoiled, rotten, unafraid, because they are actually not in danger at all, Israeli spokespeople to come on and plead their case. He's cynical, lying, manipulative, smirking like George W. Bush, this lady, about the people she's killing and the lies she's thinking she's getting away with. Yeah, keep typing, Twitter Hasbarists, and keep talking, Oren and what's his name, the new ambassador? I forget his name. Douchebag. It's the Israeli Hasbara is driving people away as much as just the straight information coming from the Palestinian side. And in fact, this goes to the story of the Gallup poll. Young Americans overwhelmingly support Palestine. Well, why is that? It's because young Americans are on the internet. And so young Americans aren't exposed to decades worth of the Israeli side before they ever get to hear another point of view. Oh, what do you mean Palestine isn't the country next door that started a war, but it's the occupied reservation, maximum security prison that was conquered 45 years ago? Oh, huh. I guess it's pretty hard for Israel to be defending themselves from their captives they have locked in a prison. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys. I'm Scott Horton. Again, it's 1,888 dead Gazans so far. 84% of them civilians, 28% of them children. And And there's a huge, you know, I don't know, pro-Palestine, anti-war protest here in Austin, Texas on Saturday. And I wasn't able to go because I was being interviewed on a radio show in Fairbanks, Alaska at the time, which thanks very much, guys, for having me on. Joshua Bennett, his show. And there should be a YouTube of that, an archive of that at some point somewhere. I don't know. Maybe you'll find it. But anyway, there was quite a turnout. Thousands of people. I don't know. At least two or three city blocks worth of half of Congress Avenue. It's a pretty good-sized march. It was a damn lie when I think it was KXAN called it hundreds. That's a damn lie on the face of it. You look at the picture, that's thousands, period. There's no chance that's less than 2,500, 3,000 people, maybe more than that. Hundreds, my ass. Liars. But anyway, I believe it was the local Fox affiliate that got it right. But anyway, so that's really good to see, and there's been, you know, a lot of that kind of thing around the world of people rallying in support of Palestine. So that's one thing I want to note. I guess I need to wrap up on Palestine, and these things don't necessarily all have, you know, smooth segues between them, but they're important points I want to mention before we get to Eric Margulies on the show today. And then we've got Iraq and Ukraine and all kinds of other things. I'll try to get back to Gaza later. And maybe we'll hear back from other guests. But anyway, there's some stuff I want to cover here. First of all, my only real political position on all of this, at the bottom line, is America has to stop intervening on the side of the Israelis or anyone else, really in any conflict anywhere in the world. But on this conflict, my point is I'm against American intervention there and the American government making it their responsibility. What the Israeli government is doing. That's my political position on it. Everything else is just my personal position on it, which is this is horrible. What the U.S. government is paying the Israelis to do to the Palestinian is just madness. And back to the thing about the kids being different than their parents on this issue, it's because their parents have no idea what the hell is going on. You know? They really do believe that poor little Israel is surrounded by enemies and is only defending itself from all the Jews being pushed into the sea or whatever. And it's just complete and total nonsense. It's just not true at all. But that's why they support Israel, is because they believe that. I mean, check out all the pro-Israel talking points, not of the Hasbarists, but of the Americans who believe them. And this is what they're saying. In their mind, it's the Israelis who are pinned in the tiny little strip by the sea surrounded by enemies. But that's not true. They need to zoom in. Or, well, first, zoom out. Everybody surrounding Israel is their friend or is bogged down fighting ISIS right now. But Jordan's their friend, Egypt's their friend, and the entire Gulf Cooperation Council, whatever, are all a bunch of pro-Western sock puppets, pro-Israel sock puppets, the Saudis and the rest of them. They're not surrounded by enemies. Now zoom in, it's the Gaza Strip and the West Bank where the Palestinians are the ones who are besieged on all sides and who are being threatened, basically, yeah, with being pushed into the sea, basically. They have nowhere to go. They are not allowed to leave. They're not citizens of anything. They are refugees in an occupied territory. And so that's why the young people are against what's going on here, is because they understand that. The older people don't. The older people are so used to the Israelis being portrayed as the victims since World War II that they can't get their head around the fact that these things change. And that they have changed. And by the way, so here is a segue from that. You look at what Hamas is doing. Hamas makes a wonderful boogeyman for anybody in the world. Because why? Because they're a bunch of terrorists. They use terrorist tactics. They use suicide attacks against civilians. It's been a while since they've done that. But still. And in fact, why are they shooting rockets? They know that they're ineffectual, but they also know that they scare the hell out of Israelis. They fall the sky at more or less random when they don't get shot down. And they terrify people. And so they are bad guys. I mean, they're terrorists trying to become politicians, who, in my estimation, are even worse. That's like a terrorist grown up. They are horrible guys. But look at what it is at their goals. I mean, you can make the comparison to Al-Qaeda here. Why does a terrorist group use terrorist tactics to get what they want? What's the point? Well, in knocking down the towers, the point was to, one, wake your ass up and make you realize that you can't just go around killing everybody all the time without there being consequences, and that maybe you'd be better off not being an empire. You take that Michael Shoyer, Ron Paul point of view that we got to stop messing around over there and making these enemies. Or go ahead and fall into their sand trap and go and drown yourself in their quicksand and get all your guys killed and waste all your trillions of dollars and bankrupt and destroy your economy and sabotage your own empire and then end up bringing it home and getting the hell out of their way the hard way. Right? Same thing here with Hamas. Hamas's terms for a ceasefire, we talked about them on the show with Sheldon Richman, I guess a couple weeks ago now. Their terms for a ceasefire are, let us have the slightest bit of dignity at all. Let us have a seaport. Let us have an airport. Let us trade across borders. Import and export food and goods. And yeah, let them live. Let them have, they don't even say, give us a Palestinian state or else in there. They say, you know, let us live our lives. Please, we're begging you. Are there terms for a 10-year truce? But if that doesn't work, then what's their thing? To provoke a reaction, to make the Israelis overreact, waste a bunch of money, kill a bunch of innocent people, and destroy their very own position in the situation. It's like, a matador and his bull. It's an asymmetric thing. A bull can kick the hell out of a man, but a man is a lot smarter than a bull, right? So that's the game. It's an asymmetric fight, so it's like a matter of judo. How do you get your enemy to hurt himself in a way where all you do is basically trick him? Maybe stick your foot out and trip him, or help him flip himself off of something tall, right? Get gored in the spine. And so everybody says, Hamas terrorists, Hamas terrorists. Hamas is trying to get civilians killed because it serves their purpose. Okay, well, so stop serving their purpose then. There's truth in that. That Hamas, they're going to survive this, and ultimately, they're going to come out stronger for it because they're the only people around defending the people of Gaza. Just like George Bush and Barack Obama benefit when you have a foreign enemy. And just like Benjamin Netanyahu benefits when he has a, quote, foreign enemy, even though they're an occupied, subjugated populace. Hamas benefits when they have a foreign enemy, too. But so, if the accusation against Hamas is actually a more or less correct analysis of their tactics, why play into that? Why should George Bush tell Osama that, oh yeah, well, I'm going to prove to millions of angry young Arab men that you're right? Why should Benjamin Netanyahu say to Hamas, I'm going to prove to everybody in the Gaza Strip that you're the only bet they've got going? That you're the only ones willing to risk your lives to defend them. It's stupid. Of course, just like Bin Laden mocked George Bush for falling into the trap in his re-elect George Bush speech of 2004, where he said, all this is in my interest, not yours, but I see what's going on here. You're taking advantage for your own gain, but really I'm the one who's benefiting. Some politically connected corporations, he said. And me, he said, are benefiting from this. Same thing here. Benjamin Netanyahu benefits. His cronies benefit. His political coalition benefits. But the Israeli state suffers. Not, you know, in general and overall. And I don't mean to compare what they're going through to what the civilians of the Gaza Strip are going through. I don't mean suffer in that sense, because they're not suffering in that sense. They are not. But I mean that they're falling into the trap. They're acting like a bunch of stupids. That's how terrorism works. The action is in the reaction. See? Eric Margolies on the beginning of World War II, and the reaction to the assassination of Franz Ferdinand coming up after this break.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. All right, so our first guest on the show today is our friend Eric Margolese. He's the author of War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. He writes at the UNS Review at UNS.com, UNZ, UNS.com, at LouRockwell.com, and at his own website, EricMargolese.com. Spell it like Margolis, EricMargolese.com. And his latest piece is World War I, Tragedy of Tragedies. Welcome back to the show, Eric. How are you doing?
Thanks, Scott. Well, I'm feeling very somber today because of the anniversary of World War I, and today is the anniversary of the crushing of the Belgian forts in Liège in 1914 that were done by Germany's 420-millimeter cannon. Those are 16-inch cannon that destroyed Belgian resistance.
And so that was the first major outbreak of fighting in the war then?
That's right, Scott. Mm-hmm. The Belgians put up enough resistance long enough that it delayed the German plan to cut through Belgium and slice down across the north of France, set the German timetable back by about 2 or 3 days. And those critical days, because the Germans in the Schlieffen plan, their plan was to race through northern France, that's Picardy, and to come around on the west side of Paris, sweep around Paris, and envelop the French forces who were facing the Germans on the other side. In fact, the Germans, the Belgian forts at Liège particularly, delayed the Germans long enough so that they weren't able to get their troops in place fast enough.
And then, boy, it's kind of, in a way, it makes you wonder what would have happened then if there had been that quick of a victory, how many lives could have been saved, how quickly French independence might have been restored anyway, but without the entire catastrophe that was still unfold here. I guess the timeline here says that this was the day that the UK declared war as well.
That's right. I forgot to add that the von Clausewitz, the great strategist, said that no war must be fought for absolute reasons or absolute goals. Wars must always end by compromise. And, in fact, this is one of the first great tragedies of the war. That, if the Germans had won early in the war, they would have made a deal with the French, and the French would have had to cough up some money, and Germany would have been the leader in Europe. But the horrors of World War I, 10 million soldiers killed, could largely have been avoided, just that the other catastrophe was America's foolishness, Woodrow Wilson's folly in sending American troops, a million troops to France in 1917 and 18, that tipped the balance against Germany and prevented a stalemate that would have led to a reasonable and fair peace, we can assume.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, I definitely want to get back to that question in the second segment because I think it's, among the most important discussions to be had ever anywhere. So we definitely want to talk about Woodrow Wilson and the tipping of that balance. But to rewind a little bit back here to the beginning of the war, World War II, I read somewhere sometimes, the guy said his son knows what happened in World War II. Some really bad fascist militarists popped up and America had to go whoop their ass back down again. And that's just the way it is. And then we befriended our enemies after we were done beating them. And that's it's a pretty simple narrative, World War II. But his young son couldn't tell you a thing about World War I because nobody really knows Nobody has a simple narrative that they can tell you about World War One. All they know is a big complicated mess and a bunch of people died, and they're not even sure it's interesting, Eric. It's actually just a real bad thing that happened or something. So I was hoping maybe you could give us a little bit of context about what the hell was really going on here to make Europe tear itself apart this way, or the politicians of the countries that make up Europe.
I did a Swiss, like a master's degree in the diplomatic history of Europe from the Congress of Berlin in 1878 to 1914. So I'm well familiar with it. There's a new book out called The Sleepwalkers, which brilliantly details what happened. And what happened was 40 years of backstabbing and one-upsmanship, and between the major powers, that's Russia, the Austro-Hungarians, France, and Germany, and all kinds of plots and intrigues, and each of the country and the little countries, their Balkan clients, trying to grab more land. And it reminds me of what's going on in Ukraine now. It's an area that really no one should care about, but the way France and Germany, they had no real serious interest in the Balkans, but they got sucked into this snake pit of intrigue and attempts to overthrow governments and little wars. And that eventually all added up to this big explosion in 1914.
And now, weren't all these kings and queens and princes all first cousins with each other and all of that? How did it all become so inevitable, I guess? You know, you mentioned the Scheifen plan there. I guess my impression was that, and I can totally see any kind of bureaucracy in the world being just like this, too. If Russia does this, then we do that, no matter what. Once you encode it down on paper like that and make it a matter of quantity, not quantity, then human judgment falls to the side, and we go ahead and do that thing even if we know better now.
This war has so many lessons for us. It should be studied and restudied. Many of the problems that we have today, the Middle East, the Balkans, for example, even Russia, Ukraine, date from World War One. And that's what caused the problems, issues that have never been resolved. But what's so interesting in this period is that you say French policy or German policy, but it really, foreign policy was made by cliques of officials in these countries, often in competition with each other, and certainly not in coordination. So, for example, in France, they were pro-German or certainly anti-German cliques, as England was infused with anti-German officials in the foreign policy network of Britain. Mm-hmm. And you can see that eventually these groups were like today's neocons in Washington, gradually gained dominance and propelled the great powers into war against each other.
Mm. Well, and I guess that would have to include the generals too, right? In all the various countries.
Definitely. There was a very good book years ago about the British generals in World War One called The Donkeys. And it was right. But what's interesting is that the French and British generals, and the Belgian generals too, got all their military experience in colonial wars in Africa and Asia. I mean, they were good in mowing down tribesmen armed with spears. But when they met the Germans, they didn't know what to do. I've often said that same problem with the United States. Our whole military now has been attuned to fighting guerrilla wars in third world countries. What's going to happen if we have to really meet a real army? We're not going to be ready.
Right. Well, and in the same sense, the reason they get whooped in all these guerrilla wars is because the last great war they won was the giant tank battle against Saddam's forces in 91, where it absolutely was a cakewalk, and they didn't have an Iraqi tank got a single kill in that entire thing. And they thought, oh, look, all we got to do is just push buttons to win wars, no problem. And meanwhile, they get taken out by IEDs on the side of the road. You know?
That's true. You know, the last war is almost always deceptive. Generals always try and fight the last war, as is famously said, but they're usually fighting the wrong war. And the generals in 1914 were not ready for modern technology. They were still 30, 40 years behind the times.
Right. Next, we're going to be fighting Russia with our mine-resistant vehicles. You know, like they're the Mujahideen. All right, I'm sorry. We'll be right back with Eric Margulies in just a sec, y'all.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. We're talking World War I with Eric Margulies, ericmargulies.com. American Raj, Liberation or Domination. Those are his books. Eric, let's talk about Vladimir Lenin for a minute here. There's a great book by Jim Powell called Wilson's War. And in that book, he makes the case that one ought to remember, for starters, that the original Russian Revolution was in March of 1917, and that it took Lenin and Trotsky four tries before they were able to seize power and create the USSR of death and pain and starvation and totalitarianism and all the horrible consequences that came from that, including even the rise of Mao Zedong and communism in Asia, East Asia. And so anyway, Powell makes the case that Kerensky and the interim government, even if they wanted to stay in the war, they only could have stayed in the war, and they only could stay in the war, because Woodrow Wilson started paying their bills and started supplying them with primitive lend-lease, basically, to keep them in the war, which makes sense, right, to try to keep the Germans divided on two fronts to if you're going to fight them from the West. But that was part of the American intervention, and that only because of the American intervention then was the Russian army still out there on the front instead of back home where they could have protected the Kerensky government and spared the world communist totalitarianism?
Scott, I am not familiar with the amount of aid that the U.S. delivered in 1917 to Russia. I know there was some, but nor do I understand if that propped up the Kerensky government. What I do know is that the communist takeover was not a people's revolution. It was a military coup. And I've been in the exact room, the Hall of Mirrors, in the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg, where Kerensky was working at the desk, and the Russian cruiser Aurora came and it shone its searchlights into that room. And Bullhorn loudspeaker said that where the light could go, shells would follow, and that they were going to open our fire with their 6-inch guns if Kerensky didn't resign. And he did. He resigned. He handed over the government, which is pretty feeble at the time, to the Bolsheviks. And of all things, Kerensky ended up teaching at UCLA in Los Angeles.
He did. I had no idea that.
He did, and he died. I mean, I was amazed to learn this. He died in California, completely forgotten by history.
Wow. Oh, that's amazing. All right, then. Okay, now, to your point, I wanted to let you elaborate what you were trying to say. I guess you're focused much more on the German and Ottoman angle to that same argument that the tipping of the balance by America in the war led to far worse consequences than the original war itself, which already was the Great War, the worst thing that had ever happened since Genghis Khan, or maybe even including.
It certainly did. It was a primary historical tragedy. And it's odd because in those days, World War I, the largest single ethnic group in America were Germans. We don't see this today because all the Schmidts became Smiths, and everybody anglicized their names, but there was a very strong German contingent in the United States. And there was a great deal of sympathy for Germany. In 1900, Scott, the third largest German city in the world was my hometown, New York City. That's been erased from our memory. What brought us into the war were with British propaganda. The British, very cleverly, they controlled the Atlantic cable. They managed to feed the American with all kinds of horror stories about Germany.
Oh, wait a minute. Your phone's breaking up on us a little bit there.
Sorry.
You got a loose cord?
No, I don't have a cord. Can you hear me now?
Oh, no. Are you on a cordless phone?
Yes.
Oh, I see. Maybe angle your antenna back toward the base a little bit or something.
Okay,
yeah, I just want to make sure we get you loud and clear here. So
better?
You were saying the British controlled the cable.
Poured all kinds of, though they had unique control of it, so they poured all kinds of outrageous propaganda about German soldiers, spiky babies, and it was very successful. A group of American bankers also wanted the U.S. to go to war. They were very influential. And propaganda and deception set the scene for President Wilson, who was something of an oddball himself, to throw America into the war and to reverse the course of the war just when the Allies and the Central Powers were completely exhausted and very close to having forced them to talk peace.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't even that the Germans were about to defeat the French. It was really both sides were. Their soldiers were just laying down dead and or too damn tired to fight anymore, and that was it. Too cold.
The Germans had the military initiative, but they didn't have enough men in the end to seize Paris. Germany and Austria, Hungary Empire, were being starved by a British naval blockade, which is illegal under international law. Same thing that's happening to Gaza now. So the Central Powers, Germany, Austria, Hungary, were on the verge of collapse and riots and civil unrest. They couldn't feed their people. The French and the British were just holding on with their fingernails to keep the Germans, who were, I don't know, 30, 40 kilometers away from Paris, not very far. That was just the tipping point of the war, and just at that point, General Black Jack Pershing arrived in Le Havre and Boulogne, I think, with the American contingents. And then suddenly everybody knew that the war was lost for the Germans.
Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, they kept that blockade for how long after the ceasing of hostilities there?
Oh, I think at least a year. They starved Germany into accepting the drastic terms, the rapacious terms of the Versailles Treaty. And this, of course, that evil treaty took away 7 million German citizens and 10% of Germany's territory. It completely dismembered Austria-Hungary and created Czechoslovakia, Greater Romania, Greater Serbia, or Yugoslavia, rather. So it poisoned the well completely.
Mm. All right, now, we're almost out of time for this segment. Can I keep you one more? Because I want to talk about the British Mandate and the redrawing of the lines in the Middle East and the Cold War and the rest of the results of this thing, if you got the time.
Subject dear to my heart.
Okay, great. Well, you heard it. He's got an advanced degree in the subject of World War I. It says here in this latest article at unzuns.com, Eric has walked the battlefields, at least on the Western Front. He's a real expert in the First World War and Woodrow Wilson's massive, I guess not original, but damn near original sin that ruined the 20th century for mankind. Anyway, we'll be right back with the great Eric Margolies, author of American Raj and writer at uns.com, right after this. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate.
And if you'd like to learn and order more, send him a message at commoditydiscs.com or check him out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Oh, yeah, I should mention, I got a website, scotthorton.org. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. All right. Talking with Eric Margolese about the First World War, and even worse than that, Woodrow Wilson's American intervention in the First World War. And so I wanted to ask you about the role played, especially specifically there, the American intervention in the rise of the Nazis on the stab in the back theory. Wasn't it Wilson that said, I don't know what he's thinking here, if he's thinking at all, but that the German militarists who had actually waged the war, why, sort of like in a Dick Cheney way, they're such bad guys that we won't even talk to them to accept their surrender. We have to have a regime change in Germany and put in good German Democrats that Woodrow Wilson approves of, and then make them accept the terms of the surrender. So then that way, all the Democrats ended up blamed for the German defeat. And Hitler always said, oh, they're the traitors of 1918 who stabbed us in the back when we were right about to win.
Well, that's true. You know, Hitler was lying about it. The Germans were not about to win. They were close. They weren't so much stabbed in the back as the fact that there was threat of internal revolution in Germany, just as what happened in Russia. But Wilson was showing the. But he was a religious fundamentalist. He was an ardent Presbyterian, a moral deacon for the world, and he had this kind of absolutist view. He was mocked by the other allies and during the Versailles Treaty. They thought him as a backwoods rube, but they had to go along with him because America was so rich and powerful. But in fact, it was Wilson's intervention that created, as we said, this catastrophe after the war.
Mm-hmm. And now, you know, just thinking back on my kind of public school education that I got and that kind of thing, it was always emphasized that, yeah, you know, it's true that the Versailles Treaty and all the war debts that were put on Germany, that the Americans loaned them the money to pay back the French and the British for a while and whatever, but then they printed the rest and it destroyed the economy. We hear a little bit of that as kids, I think, in the role of the rise of the Nazis, because there's got to be some explanation, and government school even will admit to blowback from World War One when it comes to the rise of the Nazis. But the thing that they never really explain is about all the lost territories. Of course, you know, the hyperinflation, all that was in the 20s. So what explains the rise of Nazism through 1933, and then they're staying in power with such an iron grip through, you know, the start of the war, through the end of the war? It was that claim to regain what had been unfairly stripped away. And,
that's right.
And I think
Germany,
it's a lot more extensive than Americans would guess.
That's right. And Germany had been humiliated at Versailles, a very proud nation. You know, Germany was the leading industrial power of Europe. Not only that, but it had the most developed social responsibility system for pensions and workmen's compensation and working hours and all of this. And the British and French capitalists took great alarm at this. This is a point that never comes up either, that Germany was socially progressive, and they thought this might infect their own downtrodden working forces.
Before the war, and you're saying that was part of the reason they wanted to get into the war against the Kaiser?
That's right. That's right. I'm sorry I went off track on that, but the loss of territory was terrible, and the Germans, who suddenly found themselves in Czechoslovakia, there were millions of Germans stranded, marooned in Czechoslovakia. Czechs began attacking them and committing atrocities against them in the Sudetenland, in the ex-Austro-Hungarian Empire. There were 8 million Germans stranded in Eastern Europe by the Treaty of Versailles, and who had been there for centuries. So this became a major issue for the Germans. And one can't blame them in a way for being upset, seeing their country humiliated. You know, the defeat of Russia, Stalin also said that his primary objective was to regain all the territory that Russia lost in World War I, 1917, at the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk.
All right, and then now in the Middle East, too, if America had stayed out, what would have been the case with the Ottoman Empire? Would they have been conquered by the British anyway? They were the weakest party in that fight, right?
Probably. It was British and French power that kept the Russians from taking Constantinople, today Istanbul, the Straits, as it was known. Mm-hmm. So I think the Middle East was doomed. You know, this historian that I referred to in the book, The Sleepwalkers, very rightly points out that this whole business began in 1912 when Italy suddenly pounced on Libya and annexed it, took it away from the Ottoman Empire. That then caused all the little East European countries like Serbia and Greece and Romania to start grabbing Ottoman possessions. So the dying carcass of the Ottoman Empire, it was torn apart. But what was so pernicious was that the British and French, of course, had promised the Arabs independence. Once the Turks were expelled, and in fact they agreed in, I think it was 1916, on the Sykes-Picot Treaty to divide up the Middle East between the two of them, which they did.
And which, of course, included the Palestinian Mandate, which ended up becoming the State of Israel and a whole lot of problems right now.
To both sides.
Yeah. All right, now let me switch over to Asia for a minute here, because it was World War I that really led to America annexing the Pacific Ocean and deciding they wanted to break Japan off from their alliance with the British, right?
That's right. The British and Japanese alliance was very important, very much feared in the United States. And during the war, the Japanese intervened. They attacked the German colony at Qingdao, the place that produces the beer we drink today, or Tsingtao, and they suddenly Japan emerged as a primary power in the region, and the U.S. then seized Samoa, the island in the middle of nowhere in the Pacific, which had been a tiny little German possession. But this brought the U.S. into direct confrontation with Japan that would culminate 20 years later in Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. Man, isn't that something, too? That Woodrow Wilson. And it's funny, too, because he really does have the legacy. If anybody knows about him in government school, really what they teach is he was such an idealist and all he wanted was peace on Earth. And the only thing he ever did wrong was he just wasn't persuasive enough in getting the League of Nations passed. That would have prevented all this terrible stuff we're talking about, Eric.
And he didn't understand a lot of really what the details of these complicated situations, the history of the area, or the deviousness of his allies, the British and French and the Italians, who had completely different agendas. It's too bad the League of Nations never was well established, but it was seen, as the United Nations is today, as an instrument of the Western great powers.
Yeah, I mean, the losers of the central powers in the fight, they weren't going to get an equal seat. The Germans next to the British on the council, were they? Was that ever even in the plan?
Not at all. So Wilson's ideas sounded very nice on paper, but in reality, they were not. And, the best you can say about Wilson, in my view, is that while he made a terrible blunder for the era of sending American troops into World War I, that was the first major step in America becoming a world power.
Yeah, well, in a world empire.
A world empire.
Yeah, blood-soaked one as bad as any of our enemies by now. But, all right, well, thanks very much, Eric. I sure do appreciate your time on the show today.
It's been a pleasure, Scott.
All right, y'all, that's the great Eric Margulies. World War I, Tragedy of Tragedies, is the article today at UNZ, UNZ.com. We'll be right back.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I got extremely huge and important Iraq news coming up on the show for you. But I do need to get back to Israel-Palestine for a moment here. At least for this segment. There are a few more things that I think need covering. First of all, I don't know if you guys saw this, but this morning in Jerusalem, a Palestinian, or an Arab Israeli, I guess they're saying he's an Israeli citizen, took a backhoe and attacked a city bus with it and tipped the damn thing over with the claw. And then, I guess, I don't really know, because I don't have assistants helping me do the show or anything like that, and I ain't got time to Google every damn thing, but I did see a tweet from Jews Against Zionism this morning that said that the man, the single man who was killed, the bus driver survived, there's no one else in the bus, but a pedestrian apparently was crushed to death, and according to the Jews Against Zionism tweet that I saw, he was an anti-Zionist, and an anti-war guy was killed in this terrorist attack against an innocent civilian. Turns out, not only was he innocent, he was on the attacker's same side, in spirit anyway. And so, it just goes to show, you know, what happens when you're shooting bulldozers or artillery shells at innocent people. You really never know who you're killing. It could have been that one of those 300-something babies the Israelis have killed so far had 190 IQ, was going to invent the cure for God knows what, but we'll never have a chance to know. Not like that's their value in life is what they're worth to others, but I'm just saying, you never know the lost opportunity cost when it comes to blowing stuff up to death all the time. When it comes to tipping a bus over onto some guy walking on the sidewalk. Jesus Christ. Never mind what bad PR that is for the Palestinian people who are the innocent victims in this. Because that's really beside the point. It really is beside the point. I mean, it's something. But... Oh, good. Mark Thornton's going to be on the show today. Yes. Great. I like talking with Mark Thornton. He's a good guy, man. Cool. Mark Thornton. Yeah. See? There you go. All right. And then also, well, let me just mention real quick the BDS thing. I don't have any money, so I don't spend any money on anything. So I don't ever really participate in any kind of boycotts because, you know, like, what am I going to do? Buy stock in a company? Any company? No. So I don't really have to pick and choose which company I buy stock in, you know what I mean? But it is important, the BDS thing, and I support it. And so I should get people on the show to talk about it and that kind of thing, and I'll try to do a better job at that. But that is something that is being done, that is a peaceful market process, a boycott in Europe and in the United States and I guess around the world to divest from companies that do business with Israel. And started out, I think, just against companies doing business in the occupied territories, you know, in the settlements there, as they call them, the colonies. But it spread to the whole state of Israel now. I guess depending on who's doing what boycott, it's not a uniform thing. But anyway, I think it's important, if only because it really goes to show the widespread nature of the support for the Palestinians. And that there is actually another side to the story here that maybe you hadn't heard. Which goes to another thing I want to talk about, which is Patrick Coburn's piece,
which is running on antiwar.com today and is great, asking, what has Israel won with all this violence? And one of the things he mentions in there is that the Israeli government, and I guess to a great degree the Israeli society, they really do believe their own BS all the time. They really do. And I highly recommend, and I've never been there or anything, but I talked with Max Blumenthal a bunch of times. And I've seen this documentary, Defamation. Have you ever seen it? Came out in about 2006. And it's about the absolute nonsense, absolute lie that the Israeli people are fed by their government all day, every day. And what it amounts to is that everyone who is not a Jew only wants to kill you. All of them. That's the only reason non-Jews exist in the world. They only make more of each other so that one day they can kill us all. All they do when they get out of bed in the morning is they think about trying to kill us. And all they do when they finally give up exhausted and have to go to bed at night is they dream about killing us. And it is the biggest, stupidest, most ridiculous, nonsensical lie in the whole world. It's just absolutely nonsense. And yet, there is apparently a real majority consensus of the truth in this. You know, it amounts to a mystical faith. And it gets to ridiculous proportions in the movie, where the children, high school kids, are touring Poland and the sites of the Holocaust, but they're walking around as though they're surrounded by Nazis trying to kill them now. In our modern day, they're walking through, in this one scene, they're walking through this, like, grassy field and this beautiful blue sky and trees and birds chirping and all this stuff. And they're looking around for the anti-Semites that are coming to kill them. Even though that was in the 40s. That's the worst thing. It's so horrible, but it's not happening right now. And yet, I mean, the closest parallel I can understand in my life is 2002 and how Americans were in 2002. It was absolutely unreal, the amount of deference that the lying, murdering American government got. The most incompetent boobs ever to be in charge of this state got absolute deference from the American people out of fear because they believed a bunch of crap. Oh yeah, every Arab at every gas station is part of some Al-Qaeda plot to raise your prices or whatever. Everybody's just making up their own bullcrap to try to make the level of emergency that the government was telling us we were in make sense to them. You know? Every Muslim is a terrorist and all this crap. And I think a lot of Americans are really over it by now. After Iraq and Afghanistan and Hurricane Katrina and Barack Obama and the rest, they're pretty jaded. Barack Obama, he is just another one of George Bush's crises, right? Thanks a lot for being so horrible that this guy won. On the other side, people are pretty jaded about that. That atmosphere has subsided quite a bit in America, not all the way. Certainly, terrorism still serves as a massive excuse, but the American people aren't as caught up in the propaganda and in the fear as they used to be. But in Israel, this is just an ongoing thing all the time. So you really can have an absolute regional hegemon armed to the teeth with hydrogen bombs, with naval destroyers and submarines and advanced weapons of every kind. All of America's best fighter planes and everything else, AWACS for air traffic control in wartime and all the rest of everything that they need. And they really believe, just like your dumbass uncle on Facebook, they really believe that they are the poor, downtrodden underdog in this fight. They convince themselves that in and out of government. They convince themselves that. And of course, the entire population is conscripted at one point or another. So that whole we the people thing really means a lot more there than here, where everybody really is participating and identifying with the democracy and with the state of the government there. And yes, I mean democracy within very limited borders and categories of people who are included, etc. But you understand what I mean. Watch that show, Defamation. It'll blow your mind, man. It's made by an Israeli Jew who's saying, I'm interested in all this anti-Semitism. I want to go and find some, you know? And he's just, You can watch the whole damn thing on YouTube. And I think that's an important part of what's going on here. And again, Patrick Coburn's article is running today on antiwar.com. It's called What Has Israel Achieved in 26 Bloody Days? And he, of course, has been there, man. And he talks about he toured Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Lebanon right after Ariel Sharon was done massacring, well, you know, aiding and abetting the massacre of by the Flangelist militias of all the women and children there back then. So really a hell of an article today running. It's in the Independent, I think at UNS Review too, probably. Yeah, it's at UNS.com. Patrick Coburn, What Has Israel Achieved in 26 Bloody Days? Read that real quick during the commercial. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm going to change things up for a minute here and talk with our friend Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He's a senior resident fellow there. He is the book review editor of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics and is the author of The Economics of Prohibition and the co-author of Tariffs, Blockades, and Inflation, The Economics of the Civil War, and other books, too. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Mark?
Hey, Scott. I'm doing great. Great to be back on the show. I'm actually vacationing in New Mexico after a grueling summer at the Mises Institute to the Rothbard Graduate Seminar and the Mises University, which just got over with, which was outstanding. But, you know, it's a real, real long, hard week.
Right. Well, I appreciate you taking time out on your vacation, especially then to join us here. And, yeah, it's a lot of great stuff. In fact, of course, Bob Higgs on the war and all that is going to be my favorite. But can you please tell people a little bit more about that, where they can find the archives, all the great speeches and seminars and the rest of the great content? You guys know that Mises.org has about 10 zillion pages of content for free there, right? Okay, anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, we're the biggest economic content in the world, I think, in you know, of course, it's all libertarian-oriented in Austrian economics. And for the Mises University, you know, we had like 150 people there. We had Judge Napolitano giving a special series of lecture. Bob Higgs, phenomenal. And the greatest Austrian economists working on the planet were there, you know, giving lectures. And they are all video-recorded or audio-recorded. They're available on Mises.org. Mises.org. It's on our YouTube channel, Mises TV or Mises Media. You really need to subscribe to Mises Media. That's a great way to keep up with what's going on in the world of Austrian free market economics. But yeah, it's all there. It's all for free.
Great. Yeah, and it's all, you know, grade A stuff too, of course. All right. Now, so here's the thing I want to ask you about, and I hope people will remain engaged, even if, like me, they're mostly anti-war people and not so much economics-based or whatever, because I don't really want to talk theory like high theory. I want to talk theory like, it seems to me, the most important thing in the world, other than the empire, but of course it's all intertwined with the empire anyway, and that is the American central banking system and the boom and the bust cycle. And it just seems like there's, you know, if we were to count all the dislocations that come out of that Federal Reserve system around the world, we could never really stop. But anyway, tell us how it, where it starts. What's going on with this thing here, Mark?
Well, I'll start with an apology, Scott, because, you know, Austrian economists make a big deal about, you know, the interconnections between central banking and war. And very often I come on your program and I fail to make that connection, but it's the central bank that makes it possible for the empire to pay for the empire and to cover up the cost of the empire, because it gives the government the ability to just print up money. And so it's not surprising that the Federal Reserve was founded and put into effect right before we got into World War I. And, you know, and then in 1971, we went off the gold standard because of the cost of the Vietnam War. And so what we've seen since then is just a ratcheting, continuing process where the central bank makes it easy for the U.S. to pay for wars and to pay for the empire. And, you know, basically it's been monetizing anywhere from $500 billion to $1 trillion of government expenditure, which is the same cost, the same monetary cost, of course, not in terms of lives, that we expend overseas on this empire. So it's all very much interconnected. But in addition to financing these wars and this empire and all these bases, you know, this increase in the money supply and the adjusting of the interest rates by the Fed also causes the business cycle, and it also causes inflation or the prices of goods to go up. So all of this is very much connected, and your people are very important in terms of fighting the war part of it, but we're all fighting that same battle against big government.
Yeah, I think, well, there's a lot of things to go back over there. But yeah, I think first premise would be that most people who aren't too educated about this kind of thing at all, just going by basic assumptions, TV understandings of the world, they figure that what the government spends is what they tax us, and then, yeah, plus they borrow some from China, that kind of thing. But without any kind of, it's never explained really on TV, the process of how new money gets created, new bank credit gets created, and how government, you know, gets away with their biggest projects like the wars, you know, things along those lines. I know from when I was a kid, I learned about inflation. This is why it's a crime. This is one of my first lessons in supply and demand, even, was why it's a crime to counterfeit money. Why can't I just print all my own money and buy all the wonderful things that I want or whatever? Well, and the answer is because you'd be ripping off your neighbors by diluting the value of the money out there on the market, basically. And that's why it's a crime, is because it amounts to stealing. It's the same thing. And so as bad as that is, and people living with rising prices all the time, but then you add on top of that, I think what you mentioned there is the most important thing of all, is the boom and the bust cycle. And as you called it, it's the business cycle. That's the official name of it. And I'm not sure that there's no such thing as a business cycle, but the one that we have, the boom and the bust that we have, certainly seems to be you know, engineered or a result, not engineered deliberately, or I don't know, but certainly seems to be a result of all this bank credit expansion. And that, you know, the boom part is fine, but the bust is just something else, Mark.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. The central bank, the Fed, is the banker's bank, okay? So the big banks keep money with the Fed. And what the Fed does is it buys government bonds from the banks, and then it just puts money into their account at the Federal Reserve with electronic entries, just like, you know, when you cash your deposit your paycheck, it's an electronic entry into the bank. And, you know, that's all fine and good, but if the Fed is really buying up lots of government bonds and keeping interest rates real low, these banks have all this extra money at the Fed, they start lending it out into the economy, and, you know, that sometimes come in the form of low interest rate mortgages, like in the 2000s. And so people started buying up houses. People started building houses. The price of houses goes up, and they ended up engineering this incredible housing bubble with all these, you know, derivatives and fancy financial products. And they gave people the impression that housing prices were going to continue to rise forever. But of course, those kind of things never happen. Things never go up constantly forever. And they saddled the American people with all this incredible debt and almost brought the financial system down completely. And it's all basically the fault of the central bank, the Federal Reserve, and its outrageous, outlandish monetary policy and controlling the interest rate to make people believe that there's this super prosperity going out there. So we feel like the boom is the good part, but that's actually when we're all making the mistakes of making investments in housing and making investments in construction company, making investments in mortgage companies. And, you know, so that's when all we feel good, but that's when we're all making the same mistakes And those same mistakes are only revealed to us when the bust comes, when the inevitable bust comes, when there's too many houses to possibly justify the high housing prices. And, of course, you see the collapse in housing prices and people going underwater with their mortgages and having to default on their mortgages and being foreclosed by the banks and losing their home. And so, you know, the end result is terrible for the American people. And it's just...
You can wrap up that thought. You got 30 seconds.
Well, it's just, you know, the Fed is the cause of that housing bubble, and it ruined a lot of Americans' lives, and they're up to no good once again.
Right. All right. Now, that's a great place to stop. We'll be right back, everybody, with the great Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute at Mises.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Mark Thornton, he called the last housing bubble back in 2005. Him and Robert Blumen over there at the Mises Institute, they were the first on Earth. And we're talking about the boom and the bust, and of course started out talking about how it's all very necessary, this artificial bank credit expansion in order to fund the empire, and it's unlimited expansion, apparently. Sun never sets on it, that's for sure. But Mark, when you're describing the period of artificial prosperity, like, for example, during the last bubble, it seems to me like those times, the Bush years, actually really sucked for most people. I guess if you owned a house in a market where the value was going up all the time and you could keep refinancing it and cashing out and buying a new truck all the time and a granite countertop and all that crap, then maybe it felt like a kind of boost to those people, you know, that segment of the economy. But I don't remember the Bush years ever really seeming like there had been a recovery and a real kind of state of growth. And for that matter, the 90s sure seemed more prosperous. But I remember even in the 1990s going, well, yeah, but we got record bankruptcies and we've got, you know, all kinds of people suffering in a lot of ways. We have price inflation in a lot of ways. And so even this artificial prosperity that you talk about, it seems really pretty artificial, and only the people who are really in on the game with the government are the ones who get the result of the boom, and then we all still suffer the bust, and they say real wages haven't gone up in 40 years or something. It would seem like maybe that's part of why. I don't know.
Yeah, it is a false prosperity. There's no doubt about it.
Because that's what's going on right now, right? TV is saying, well, this is the jobless recovery. So right now we're in, what, circa 2004. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, we're right back in it. We're right back in the bubble. And, you know, there's a lot of wealth redistribution that goes on because of the Fed's policy. So it's really only the people who get this new money that are actually going to be prosperous. It's only people who are already pre-positioned with the assets that are going to be the bubble that are going to prosper. Everybody else is not going to be helped. So that if you were just married, single couple, looking for a house in a housing bubble, well, you would be at a great disadvantage. You'd be buying in at inflated prices, and, you know, and then when the bust comes and you're not able to make your mortgage payment, then you're going to go bankrupt. So there's winners and losers, and overall the economy is actually worse off over the stretch of the business cycle. The economy is less well off. We're destroying wealth and productive capacity by making all these bad investments. And so it's only really, in terms of the boom, there's really a minority of people who benefit. And, of course, bankers tend to benefit from the boom. And whatever industry that is getting this new money, back in the 2000s, in the 1990s, it was the tech industry that was getting all the resources. They were getting access to new money, And then after they collapsed, Bush started the and Greenspan started to bubble up again with 1% federal funds rates, and that was channeled into the housing industry by government policies, the Community Reinvestment Act, and a bunch of regulations and rules that favored housing over alternative investments. And so, you know, a lot of people were ruined by the housing bubble. A lot of people were made incredibly wealthy. And the same is true for today.
Yeah, just the same thing over and over again. All right, now, so what about, you know, I read sometimes, and never mind the specific, you know, problems going on in Ukraine right now, for example, but just kind of in general, I read of people in Eastern Europe saying they miss the Soviet Union. And I wonder whether it's okay for me to just go ahead and blame all of that on Alan Greenspan, Bill Clinton, and George Bush and their boom and bust cycles, instead of saying, good, communism's gone, here's the free market. We gave them this sick, corrupt, crony system based on our global dollar, right? The world's only so big, and America's the center of it as far as finance and economics and everything else goes, or that's how it has been. And so is that really right, that it's America's fault that everybody in Eastern Europe has had such a bad time post-communism instead of, you know, celebrating in the streets to this day?
Well, let's put it this way. We've had a negative effect on the development of the economies of Eastern Europe. We've held them back in many respects, but they have made progress. I mean, many of the countries of the former Soviet Union have done better. For example, Poland is, you know, a economic success story. Its economy is growing at a very nice pace. The Czech Republic has done well.
But is that bubble activity or is that real growth?
I think it's more growth. And I think it's, but it's always hard to tell because a lot of their success has been as a result of their economic connections with Germany, who has done extremely well relative to the rest of Europe, which has been screwed up by our central bank and dollar policy. Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, you just can't get away from the permeating effects of our central bank and our monetary system, which is, you know, it's the ruling monetary system of the world. Our dollar is the reserve currency of central banks around the world, and the dollar is the thing that is used to transact most international transactions. And so this also relates to the empire and war, is that the U.S. dollar gives us this special monopoly status that we can draw on and impact all these countries from around the world. There's very few people who can get away from the influence that the dollar has. And so even the BRIC countries, you know, as they expanded based on our monetary policy, but a change in our monetary policy could see, you know, their economies collapsing. And that's why China and Russia, Brazil, South Africa, and India are very concerned about what we have done and what we are currently doing. And I think countries like China and India and, of course, Russia are pushing back now. And all this business, this saber-rattling in Ukraine may be in part the result of Putin and the Soviet Union being disgruntled about our special status in this world and about our ability to print our way out of problems.
Right. Well, and by the way, I was going to ask you, Russia notwithstanding, what about this national debt that's now $17 trillion, I guess, counting on $18 trillion? Can we go up to $38 trillion or $58 trillion? Or, I mean, why not? Can we keep going forever or not? Oh, and
well,
you have no time to answer at all. Sorry.
It's going to go up, no doubt about it.
Yeah. And then, but can they just keep going forever, or the laws of economics are going to come due, Mark?
the laws of economics will prevail, and if they keep on pushing the debt up higher and higher, we're going to end up in a hyperinflationary economy that could break us in the long haul.
That's Mark Thornton at Mises.org. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you, Scott.
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
Oh, great, man. Just as the music starts playing, our friend Steven Zunis calls in on the Skype from Greece. Hi, Steven. How are you doing?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing really good. Oh, let me turn you down here. Back off that microphone just a little bit for me. Thanks. I'm sorry. I don't have it in front of me. You're the professor of what all now?
I am professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, where I chair the Middle Eastern Studies program. And I'm here in Greece. I'm bound for an academic conference in Istanbul next week, but I'm taking a vacation with my family. We're in an outdoor cafe in the shadow of the Acropolis, so I don't have just finishing up dinner, so I don't have too long, but I wanted to give you all a few minutes if you wanted to discuss Gaza or whatever you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, great, man. What a scene. Right there in the shadow of the Acropolis, huh? Right on. All right, well, first of all, before we get started, I have a correction. Earlier, I said I wasn't aware of anything but speculation about the so-called Hannibal procedure or doctrine or whatever it's called. But that is incorrect. Here it is in Haaretz that, yes, they have official Israeli government and military sources saying that, yes, they did resort, in fact, to this Hannibal procedure when it came to blowing up their own guy, Lieutenant Hadar Golden, who was... had very temporarily captured by Hamas before they were all blasted with artillery, which is just amazing to me. Can you imagine American generals saying, yes, that's our policy, is we shoot artillery at any Marines or Army being captured by the enemy?
Israel's been violating a lot of international norms, particularly bombing civilians, bombing... telling people they had to flee to safe areas in these United Nations controlled schools, and then attacking the schools. There have been no less than 7 attacks against schools, and the Israelis and their bipartisan supporters in Washington that say, oh, well, Hamas stored some rockets in some schools or other military equipment, which of course is bad, really is illegal, but these were unoccupied schools. The ones that were attacked by the Israelis had refugees in them. There were no military activities or equipment anywhere near them. The United Nations had given the coordinates of these places and saying, look, these are refugees here. There's no military activity here, and they attacked them anyway. Indeed, Israel has killed more children than they have fighters, and yet, just last week, by a huge bipartisan majority in the House of Representatives. In fact, it was so overwhelming that even had just had a voice vote, but it had like scores of co-sponsors, both Republicans and Democrats, claimed that Israel had no culpability whatsoever for any of the civilian deaths. It was all Hamas's fault. They are using human shields. And this is just after Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the United Nations had said that while Hamas had been doing some illegal things like lobbing rockets into Israel and storing equipment in unoccupied UN facilities and doing some other things they shouldn't do, they found no evidence whatsoever that Hamas was actually using human shields, which is basically keeping civilians against their will in harm's way as a deterrent for attack. And I have called these congressional offices, where is the evidence? Where is the evidence? And they don't have it. Basically, they're quite willing to quote Amnesty International or the UN Human Rights Council when they criticize Syria or they criticize Iran or they criticize governments the United States doesn't like. But if they criticize a government the U.S. supports, oh, my God, they're biased. You can't trust them. These guys in their air-conditioned offices in Washington, D.C. know more about what's going on the ground than the people who are there, the human rights experts, the monitors. I mean, the Democrats and these Democrats and Republicans who support this, when it comes to empirical findings of human rights organizations, they're like some Republicans on climate science. You know, they don't let the facts confuse me. It's the ideology is what counts, and it's just it's nuts there. I am the last person to apologize for Hamas. So these guys are bad news, but the atrocities by Israel had just been extraordinary. Nearly 1,000 civilian lives have been lost just in the past few weeks, and virtually all of them with U.S.-made equipment. Amnesty International called for the United States to suspend arms shipments to Israel because of these war crimes. Congress responded by increasing military aid to Israel.
All right, so a lot there. First of all, on the specific point of the human shields, it seems like now it's just a term of, you know, it's a matter of semantics and jargon. What they mean by human shields now is, well, they're fighting amongst civilians. And so, you know, but that's the same difference, right? Even though IDF headquarters can be right next to a strip mall, and, you know, they're not guilty of using human shields, even though they're just as guilty, if that's what it means now. But that's what it means now. They got to shift the definition a little bit for
them. They've rewritten it. And the definition of human shields is very clear. It's in the Fourth Geneva Convention, to which the United States and Israel and almost every country in the world are signatories to. They're basically, and here's the thing, that even if they were using human shields, that still doesn't give a country the right to attack civilians. In fact, it says that explicitly in the Fourth Geneva Convention.
Well, and that's what Israel really means by this, too, Stephen. Is they're not saying just, you know, look at how bad Hamas. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, in a domestic situation, let's say there's a botched bank robbery, and the bad guys hold some tellers and customers hostage, and let's say they're shooting at the cops. You know, would the SWAT team go in and kill the hostages along with the bank robbers and say, oh, it's not our, it's their fault, it's not ours, they're using human shields?
Well, actually, you know? That's a bad example. Because, of course, the answer is yes, the SWAT teams can kill whoever they want with impunity
there'd be outrage. There would be outrage of that kind of thing.
Right. Well, there's supposed to be,
Some police forces, unfortunately, would indeed do that. But you wouldn't have these liberal Democrats, you know, who are, you know, lining up defending what Israel's doing, you know, like Alan Grayson and Jared Polis and Jan Tarkowski and these kind of folks, you know, who are being endorsed by groups like Progressive Democrats of America and Bold Progressives and all these folks as being all these wonderful peace people. You know, you wouldn't have people like that, you know, defending if the cops do it, but yeah, sure enough, they're lining up defending Israel.
Yeah. Well, and of course, the PR, I forgot who it was that wrote a great little piece about this that we ran on the blog at antiwar.com about how it sounds like what they're saying at first on the surface is just, look at how evil Hamas is for using human shields, and it's just a talking point against Hamas. But what it really is they're writing a permission slip that it's okay to kill civilians because, after all, Hamas is the one that's putting them in harm's way, not us. So go right ahead and blast them. Don't even bother hesitating. That's the real, it's not the explicit point of the propaganda, but it's what underlies it. I'm sorry.
Here's the scary part. I have to go in just a couple of minutes, but let me finish this little piece right here. If the House resolution that passed, in addition to accusing Hamas of using human shield, mentioned that ISIS, you know, those guys, you know, who are taking over these Iraqi cities, also use human shields. Now, why would they bring that up? This resolution supposedly about Gaza. Well, you know, there's talk of a joint U.S.-Iraqi military assault on Mosul and other big Iraqi cities to try to rid them of ISIS control. If they do that, there are going to be large-scale civilian casualties. You know, and I think this is in preparation for a U.S.-Iraqi massive assault on northern Iraqi cities held by ISIS. This is not just about Israel. This is not just the thing about AIPAC or the Zionist lobby or anything like that. This is bigger than this. I think they are rewriting the laws of war to make it permissible that in the name of the war on terror, the United States and its allies can do whatever the hell they want, no matter how many civilians they kill, and it's going to be the fault of the terrorists, not the people who are actually killing the civilians.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Such an important point. You sure you can't stay one more segment here?
I know. I'm afraid I got to run. But,
all right. Well, talk to you soon. Thanks. That's Stephen Zunis, everybody. We'll be right back. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X Key Score, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org.
Oh, man, it's almost lunchtime. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks for sticking with me. That was Stephen Zunis. Yeah, it turned into a pretty good show. Three interviews, right? I didn't get to ask Stephen Zunis any of the questions that I asked him on the show to talk about. He went from my clarification of something I said on to... Hey, I agreed with what he was saying. It was important what he said about all the war crimes and all that. But I wanted to ask him about the history. Tim Snyder mentioned Stephen Zunis in a recent piece that we ran at antiwar.com. Nice big block quote there. About the terms that Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, the Fatah faction, have been willing to accept since whenever. And the point was, they're willing to recognize the state of Israel within 67 borders, even Hamas, as you might put it. They're willing to sacrifice. This was the major point. I don't know if I would have remembered it, because it only just reoccurred to me this morning right now. Earlier this morning, but again right now, not during that interview. They were willing to give up the right of return. They were willing to give up, at least their leaders, in the negotiations in the past, have given up the right, their claimed right, to come back to their homeland, where they and or their parents or grandparents were kicked out of Palestine for the creation of Israel back in 48. In exchange for help from the American taxpayer, basically, but okay, to resettle the refugees of the 48 war, and their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren that are growing up in the camps, in the refugee camps in Syria and Jordan and in Gaza, and for international help to help them resettle in the new Palestinian state, they would give up the right to come back across those 67 borders. Never mind the 48 borders, the 67 borders. And so... it was such an important point. I wanted to get him to, you know, explain that in a bit more depth there. And I'm not saying they should have to do all those things. I'm just saying, isn't that interesting? Does TV ever explain that? That even Hamas has been willing to bend over backwards this far on these issues? On recognizing Israel, on the right to come back home to Israel, even which doesn't necessarily challenge the existence of the Israeli state, only when you recognize that if they were all allowed to come back home and be citizens of Israel, then they would get to vote, and then that whole 80-20 Jewish versus Palestinian, Arab or Muslim or Christian balance would get thrown off, and they don't want that. Because, you know, it's a pseudo-ethnic, theocratic type state there. But anyway, I didn't know that. that they'd been willing to give up the right of return. I guess maybe I had forgotten it. I don't know. Anyway, I also want to talk. Oh, man, I'm almost out of time. I got to talk about the Islamic State crap in Iraq right now. I want to try to get this lady on the show. I didn't hear back, but her name is Emily Hauser. I follow her on Twitter. She writes for the Jewish Daily Forward and for Haaretz and some other places. She's a American liberal Jewish critic of Israel. And so she goes back over this kind of hazy period of history that's always very glossed over in stark terms by the pro-Israel factions of what happened between the elections of 2000, the withdrawal of 2005 of the last of the settlers from Gaza, and the elections of 06 and the rise of Hamas and the institution of the siege and all of that. And she has this piece in the foreword. She has, this lady writes a lot. So if you just put Emily Hauser, H-A-U-S-E-R, if you put Emily Hauser in Google News, you're going to find 10 things or something. So, but this one is called 9 years later. Here we go again in Gaza. So she's talking about since the withdrawal of 05. And so what she's saying is she quotes at length Dove Weisglass, Ariel Sharon's advisor, saying, by pulling out of Gaza, what we're doing is we're screwing up the basis for the second Palestinian state so badly that we'll hold the status quo forever. And the status quo being slowly colonizing the West Bank and keeping the people of Gaza hemmed up in a concentration camp. And, of course, he is absolutely right about that. But she also writes here about the elections of 2006, where, of course, the Bush administration had said, well, the Israelis, they shouldn't be bound to have to deal with an unelected government, so we have to hold elections. Well, then she says, well, the way she asks it is a rhetorical question. So, sorry, it sounds kind of funny out of context here. Well, here, I'll read you the paragraph before it, too. She says, Israel did remove all military personnel from within Gaza's borders, along with 9,000 settlers. But the IDF maintained and still maintains tight control of the strip's airspace, access to the sea, and all but one border crossing, which is controlled by Egypt and is not built for commercial traffic. This means that Israel controls nearly all movement in and out of the strip. People, medicine, building supplies, commercial goods, food, and so on. And thus Gaza remains, by all international standards, occupied by Israel. Israel didn't just pull up stakes. It locked the door and put the key in its pocket. What if, Hauser writes, what if instead Israel had negotiated with Abbas and his two state-minded Fatah party in 2005? If not actual peace, then at least security arrangements. What if, when Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice personally negotiated a transport agreement intended to make life easier on Gazans and give Fatah a post-disengagement, pre-election victory, Israel had kept its side of the bargain? How about when Hamas won those elections? What if Israel hadn't chosen to use its control of the border to, quote, put the Palestinians on a diet, but not make them die of hunger, end quote, in the hope of turning Gazans against Hamas, a tactic that's failed throughout human history? Or what if they hadn't chosen to join the Bush administration in encouraging and arming Fatah to overthrow Hamas in 2007? Or maybe when that blew up in everyone's faces and left Hamas in control of Gaza, what if someone had considered taking the Arab League up on the Arab Peace Initiative? And then she goes on. I mean, this is just two paragraphs out of this great piece that I hope you'll look at. Again, it's Emily Hauser in the foreword. 9 years later, here we go again in Gaza. And it's just one small little taste of, hey, a bunch of examples of how it did not have to be this way. How in the world did they hold an election and then Hamas won it? Why would they have held an election when it was, of course, up to the Americans and the Olmert government whether the Gazans were going to get to have an election or not? Why would they do that if they weren't going to make sure that Fatah won? And then here she says, she cites Condoleezza Rice was trying to give Fatah a political victory before the election, and the Israelis took it from them. just like I had told y'all before about the taxation and how, of course, the Israelis collect all the border taxes for the Palestinian Authority. And sometimes, like in 06, they just sit on the money and withhold it. So then that meant Fatah couldn't pay any of their so-called civil servants, couldn't pay their cronies, couldn't pay their local chiefs to bring out the vote and get the work done. And so that was what led to Hamas getting elected in the first place. And then, as she implies here, but she clearly means, they still had to be in a coalition government with Fatah in the Gaza Strip. It wasn't until Elliot Abrams, in concert with the Olmert government and Hosni Mubarak, the military dictator of Egypt, sock puppet dictator of Egypt, funneled a bunch of guns to Fatah that Hamas ended up getting and whooping their ass with and kicking them out of the Gaza Strip. She links here in the article to the Vanity Fair piece by David Rose called The Gaza Bombshell that tells that whole story. And so, and then she talks about the Arab Peace Initiative, which, again, contrary to the common right-wing talking point that Israel is surrounded by enemies, every state in the region supports them other than Syria and Iran, or if not outright recognize them and ally with them, still are perfectly getting along perfectly fine. And that goes for Egypt and, of course, Jordan and Saudi Arabia and all the Gulf states. Oh my God, I didn't get a chance to talk about the Islamic State thing going on today. The Yazidis are being killed. I thought they were safe behind Kurdish lines. Who's protecting the Yazidis that George Bush, you know, turned upside down in his war? Took control of the dam. Anyway, read this article by Hauser. It's really good. It's in the fourth. That's the show. I'm all out of time. Talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.